It's very nice sitting here. When you go on a long retreat, it's kind of weird because everything is actually kind of a dream or a memory of something. And it's amazing what the mind will remember. And so I'm sitting here realizing that this is actually a real moment where I'm sitting here looking at you. But I've spent many moments thinking about Sims and just before I left, I took a picture of this space empty. And so for 89 days, I don't know if you've ever been to IMS, but the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, but they have a 3-mile loop that you can go, and there's a lake on the other end. And so for 89 days, I would walk all the way around to get to the lake, and I'd send metta trying to visualize what we would look like sitting here together. And didn't matter whether it was raining or snowing or sun, the weather's just all over the place there. So I just am realizing that I'm not actually imagining this moment. It's kind of strange. I mean, when you do it for so long, you know, what's imagination, what's real, gets kind of blurry. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the refuges, and I thought I would start with this poem called Ancient Language by Hannah Stevenson. It says, if you stand at the edge of the forest and stare into it, every tree at the edge will blow a little extra oxygen towards you. It has been proven. Leaves have admitted it. The pines I have known have been especially candid about it. One said that all breath in this world is roped together, that breathing is the most ancient language. And in some respects, I think that's what we do when we take refuge in this practice. We're taking refuge in breathing, which doesn't really make much sense to a lot of people, but we do get quite close and personal with the breath over time. And so when I realized this year is my turn to do the refuges, I thought about this word refuge. It's a very archaic word to me. I don't really use it in my everyday language, this idea of taking refuge. I don't even think about it in any context other than the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. That's the only way I ever think about this word of refuge. So I looked it up. And it says in Webster that has three meanings for refuge. It's a shelter or protection from danger or distress. It's a place that provides shelter or protection, and it's something to which one has recourse in difficulties. And that explanation is actually pretty closely connected to the way refuge was used in Buddhist time. I read this article that one of the senior monks, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, he wrote this article about the refuges, and in it he said that that refuge was something that you took in a person or like a god. I mean, I can think of refuge in a god. I never thought of it in my practice that I'm taking refuge in God, but it's a similar kind of thing. It's a refuge in a powerful being who can protect you from danger and harm. And that kind of tradition, what you do is you'd swear allegiance to whoever that being was and or that God, and then in exchange, they would look after you and take care of you and take care of the difficulties. And it's strange that Buddha, I as, 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 at doesn't matter how long I do this practice, I am amazed at the way that Buddha can take some of the most basic things that people did in his time, the most commonest of things, and put just a slight twist in it that makes all the difference in the world. So his twist on this taking refuge is more that you're taking refuge in your own capacity. Meaning that he spoke that the dangers and the places that we needed protection from was the mind. That the mind is the danger. So you're taking kind of refuge in your own capacity to protect yourself from the mind. Or another way to think of it is to protect the mind from its own destructive nature in greed, hatred, and delusion. We're kind of protecting the mind from its own capacity to be destructive. And our allegiance, we're swearing this allegiance to our own selves, our own practice. We're not really, it's sort of like the longer you practice, the more you begin to realize that this practice does actually protect us from the dangers that come with the mind. I mean, you can just think about the times when you've been caught in some kind of greed or some aversion about something, and it is obsessive, difficult to break free of. Very difficult to break free of, especially when there's nothing else going on except for that, and you're like trying to let go of it, and it feels dangerous, as if you have some protection. Or as if you need some protection. And one of my teachers at the teacher training, in our first meeting together, I don't know if you guys have ever met him. I really hope one day we're able to bring him here. He is a monk from Uganda. He's so funny, and he talks in very strange languages. It's non-Western, and it's still Western at the same time. So it's kind of different. So just to give you a little example, I'm telling him I'm trying to get to this place in practice, and I want to hurry up and get there. And it feels like I'm not really making any progress, moving forward, and I'm complaining to him about it. And so he sits there and he looks at me and he goes, "Well, Tawari, there's three ways you could do your practice. The first way is you could think that you're in a rocking chair and you're going really fast, but you're not really going anywhere. You're like in the rocking chair, moving and moving, and you can go really fast, but you're not going anywhere. The second way is you can drive all through the neighborhood, doing about 5 miles an hour so you don't run over any kids and people. And it will take you a long time, but eventually you can make your way down the path. Or you could get on the freeway, do 70 in the fast lane, go along." So I'm like, "I want to do 70 in the fast lane. That's what I want to do." And he says, "Well, you're going to have to get out of the rocking chair, because I'm stuck sitting here in this rocking chair and I can't get out." So he's like, "You got to go back and work on how can I get out of the rocking chair, because you're not really going anywhere." And that's sort of this, there's a way in which he talks like that, that I hope one day we can bring him here. Okay, I'm going to try not to digress though, but. So this practice that we're doing, that we take refuge in, like when you are in a retreat and you strip everything away, there's a way in which you can see how much mindfulness protects the mind. So what he asked me, he said, the question I want you to, the rhetorical question to answer by the time you get to the end of the retreat is, why out of all the things that Buddha could have taught, why would he teach mindfulness? Why that? Why mindfulness? I mean, he could have taught all about loving one another, and there's a little bit of that in there, and there's, you know, the paramis and all of that, but his main focus, the thing that he sort of went on and on and on with his monastic community and his disciples and people and lay people and everybody, was mindfulness over and over and over. And that mindfulness, when you begin to see its quality, is a strong protection for the mind. And when we're caught in some mental thing that we're going to talk about over the course of the year, in the hindrances, when we're caught in these hindrances or caught in some mind energy, that finding a way to bring mindfulness into the moment protects the mind from everything. So in this refuge, even though we're taking refuge, theoretically, I mean realistically, we're taking refuge in our own ability to protect and provide shelter for our own minds, our own capacity to do that. And we do that in relation to our own practice. But formally, we call it the three jewels, the triple gem of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And so when I looked up, you know, kind of did some research with the commentaries and try to get a broader sense of this idea of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And we talk about it a lot. But I'm going to see if I can stretch it out a little bit in the last few minutes I have. So first of all, there's an external aspect of this taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And the external refuge is to take refuge in this man, Siddhartha, this person, just like you, just like me, who's got all this difficulty in our lives, just like we do, and having this kind of aspiration to find a way to get past all that difficulty. And to stay with that intention, that aspiration, all the way until there's some understanding. This kind of constantly coming back and practicing and practicing and practicing, even when things look like it's not going good, you still keep practicing. I mean, I sometimes get so impressed that Buddha is basically on his dying, he's dying there, on his deathbed, he's about to go. And then he has this memory of being a kid and how peaceful he was. And the way the sutra reads is, and then he had this thought that says, oh, I need my strength in order to investigate that. So here he is he's dying and of starvation, basically. And he has this thought, I better investigate that. So this thing that it didn't matter what was going on, he held on to this aspiration for awakening. And so externally, we can look at that historical Buddha and say, oh, I see there's a ebb and flow with practice, but I just stay with this aspiration to awaken. Or the Dhamma, you know, we learn all the lists and we have all these, like the chanting we're going to do, and monastics do all this chanting. There are all these guidelines, taking refuge in the four foundations of mindfulness so we can meditate. There's this constant outward practice that we learn these different lists and learned all these different teachings of Buddha. And then finally, taking refuge in the Sangha is that you get together with like-minded people, people in a place, and you come together and practice this. All of that is this external aspect of taking refuge. But there's equally this internal aspect of taking refuge. And the internal aspect is that in the midst of our practice, it's almost as if we draw on the sort of trust that Buddha had in this commitment towards awakening. We draw on that in order to build our own confidence so that we too get this verified sense that no matter what's going on, I can stay connected to the practice. And so this internally, it's not that we are worshiping Buddha as much as it is that we are relying or leaning, trusting in his capacity to stay with it so that when our mind seems like it's not going well or it's not going right or something's wrong, it's I can't do this and all of that, that his trust, his faith, his long-term perseverance is what we rely on. And then in our own practice, we internalize that at the same time. Or another thing you could think of is that we translate, you know, in this room, there's so many of us, but we all individually translate what we hear in the teachings and then develop that capacity in ourselves. It's almost like if I, so during my retreat, I had a really difficult time with doubt, and doubt is something I've never had. So I can remember one time going on a retreat and I said, Rodney, there's a lot of people on this retreat with doubt. I think you should talk about doubt. He goes, okay, well, let's talk about doubt. I'm like, I don't have any doubts. I don't do doubt. I just felt like I didn't have any of that. But on this past retreat, oh, geez, I spent a lot of time in doubt. And I kept trying to think about the teachings around the hindrance of doubt and what did it say and how did people teach it and what did Rodney say, what did this teacher say listening to it, but it wasn't until I translated what I thought doubt meant for me in that moment that it all began to make sense. And then being with doubt became more of a gift than it was this hindrance or this obstacle. But that's the internal taking refuge in the Buddhist teachings. We have to sort of translate what we hear into words that make sense for us, into language and practical application that makes sense to us, each of us, and then begin to develop that. And as we do that, our capacity gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and the idea of mindfulness being a refuge, being a protection and a shelter for the mind becomes real. Not something that someone says, but something that you know, and it's your go-to energy when things get difficult. And then internally, I mean, there's a way in which, if you think about it, it's kind of strange that we're all here in this space, in this room together when we came from very different walks of life and we didn't know each other and we didn't have any way of knowing that at some point we were going to come together in this way. But there's a way in which over 2,600 years, the carrying of this practice by individual monastics and individual lay people, year after year, practice after practice, generation after generation after generation, and eventually we come to hear Seattle Insight, Sims, and we're here together, coming to this path from all these different directions. But because we're here together practicing, there's a way in which our individual practice gets strengthened individually as we practice internally from the external space that we're practicing in. So all of that internal, external practicing kind of melds together. At the end, in the long run, I thought, I've been thinking about this for a month now, coming out of this retreat. I've been doing this ceremony 18 years. I can't even believe it, but 18 years. I've been coming on the first Tuesday of every year doing this ceremony. Some of you have been coming much longer than that. And some of you not that long. We all sort of come together on this first Tuesday. But I would say, I had a feeling this is going to be the year that we are going to have to depend on this practice. I mean, Sims has had ups and downs and ups and downs. But I think this year is our year that we're going to have to lean on each other. I mean, I got to admit, I go through periods, this move. Sometimes I'm scared to death. Sometimes I'm so frustrated. Sometimes I'm like disappointed. There's all this emotional energy that comes along. And I everything, you know, there's a way in which our minds see a problem and say, oh, I got the answer, and this is what we should do. And I can feel that energy that says, oh, we should do this. This is what we should do. Oh, why didn't we do that? Or why didn't we do this? And that, I just keep reminding myself, Sims is Sims is Sims. Doesn't matter where we're at. Doesn't matter how it kind of shapes out. There's a quality about us. There's a kind of a familiar way in which we are who we are, and we will always be that. And so there's a I think this year we'll need to lean on each other a little more than maybe we have been leaning on each other in the past. We'll need to take refuge in both our individual practice and this external practice that we have together, so that when we move, we do not, there'll be a bit of scattering. And I got to thinking, you know, it may be that the location isn't right, right? It's like, oh, I don't want to go there because that location, I've grown used to this location, right? So it's like, it's not the same place. It's not the same. It doesn't smell the same. It's not going to be, it's going to be different. It's going to be disrupting, unsettling. And it's in that that you need refuge. That's the whole point of refuge. We don't need refuge if everything's going good. I can remember when we first moved into this place. So we used to be at St. Mark's, and it felt so close and connected. It was like this sacred space, a church. It was great, big room. But there was that wall there, so all the people that were coming in, tossing their shoes, you didn't really hear it. And then we came here. And before we put those screens there, you used to just walk flat in here. You just walked into the room, and I can remember saying, I hate this place. We'll never, it's never gonna work. We should go back to St. Mark's. But now it feels all comfortable. But mostly it's because of our commitment and our dedication to come externally and be together and support each other and stay together. So, be prepared for the complaining. That's just going to happen. I got my own complaints. But at the same time, if you could hold in your heart the sense that we all need each other for this practice to be a refuge for us. We kind of all need each other. And so I just want to leave you with this idea that even though Sims as an organization, we can find a space, we can find some place where we all come together and meet. But it'll be we, us, together, that's going to actually create this idea of refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It's going to come from our own willingness to continue to practice together, no matter what the space or the circumstances look like. So, Tim, I got one more thing. I want to end with this quote. I'm kind of running over into Tim's time. It's so hard to talk short. So this is one of my favorite poems I want to end with is Under Ideal Conditions by Al Zolinas. He says, say in the flattest part of North Dakota on a starless, moonless night, no breath of wind, a person could light a candle, then walk away. Every now and then, they could turn and see the candle burning. 17 miles later, provided conditions remained ideal, they could still see the candle, still see the flame. Somewhere between the 17th and the 18th mile, they would lose the light. If they were to walk backwards, they would know the exact moment when they lost the flame. They could step forward and find it again, and back and forth, dark to light, light to dark. Where's the place where the light disappears, where the light reappears? Don't tell me about photons and eyeballs, reflections and refractions. Don't tell me about 186,000 miles per second and the theory of relativity. All I know is that place where the light appears and disappears, that's the place where we live. So thank you for your kind attention.
All right, good evening. Good evening, Happy New Year. I was just reflecting how Tori was saying how many years we've been doing this ceremony. I've probably been doing it, you know, 20 or more years at different locations, at Keystone, at St. Mark's, Beth Shalom, and here. And already this time of year, I mean, this early in this year, we've already had hundreds of people come through the center. So it's really a lively time when everyone kind of recommits to practice, and there's a lot of energy. You can hear it in Tweri's talk. She was bursting with her energy, with the excitement and the passion. And then we can use this energy to really align ourselves with what's really important in our practice. So Tori talked about the refuges and finding this internal and external expression of those refuges. We can also take the form of the precepts as an energy to really invest in this time of year. So these precepts, it's such an important time to commit to non-harm. Non-harm through all these different ways of our actions of our body, refraining from harming through violence, through stealing, through sexual harm, through harm from our words, from our false speech, and through intoxication. So these five precepts, this intentionality at this time of year to really commit to living a life of non-harm benefits not only our own practice in a profound way, but also touches everyone else that we come in contact within the folds of the Dharma or outside. And this shared, I love the sharedness of this, the sharedness of taking the refuge together. Could each one of us in this room, each one listening on the internet, it's like that commitment to come together. We support each other in that intentionality. We support each other in that commitment to live a life of non-harm. We're being witnessed by each other. You know, I see you put on, you chant these and taking these refuges, putting on this protection cord. We have a shared sense of accountability. As I see someone with this cord, oh, they're taking the refuges, they've held that. It reminds me to also refresh that, to regain that. Now the refuges, I think one of the geniuses of the Buddha's teachings, he takes it from this abstractness that we may have in our normal meditative practices. We may have deep insight and realizations sitting on the cushion. We may have a sense of the philosophy of Buddhism that resonates. And he says, come into your actual life. How does this actually show up in your relationships and how you interact with another person? Because that's where it really matters, and it is very revealing, because we can have this sense of open-heartedness when I'm sitting in solitude And then I go home and my wife yells at me for not taking out the trash. You know, and where does the practice show up? Where does it line up? Where does it show up in that moment? Do I come back with a quality of harshness? Or do I come with a sense of connecting with the heart? Which refuge do I choose to go into? You know, the refuge of the Dharma, of the Buddha, of the Sangha. The refuge of my wisdom and compassion. Or do I go into the refuge of my contraction, of my scarcity, of my lack? So this sense of the precepts help to bring the practice down to earth, brings it to life in the very fabric of how we live. And how do we align with non-harm? Now, as our practice matures and deepens, we start to find that we naturally align more and more with the precepts. We naturally, our heart becomes more invested in non-harm. So naturally, we find ourselves speaking in a more honest way, not taking things which are not freely offered. We start to become more attuned to how we cause harm to other living beings, how we perhaps get lost in intoxication and have a greater value, greater desire to be attentive, to be present. So the transformation of our hearts start to take some of the precepts, aspects of those off the table in terms of possibilities of crossing those. They just start becoming options. The very impulse to break some parts of the precepts start to fall away. And it's important to reflect on this, to reflect on your own life and areas that you may have struggled with in the past, those patterns of harshness, of secrecy, of lying, of stealing, are starting to fall away. It helps to gladden the heart. It helps to bring a sense of confidence in the practice, that the practice is really making a difference in my very way I live, the very way I interact with other beings, with other people. And that brings a sense of renewed energy to our practice. And it's also very important to acknowledge our edges, the places where that isn't so much happening, that we still have those areas of deep greed, of hatred, of delusion that act out through our words, through our actions, causing harm to people we know, people we don't know, the environment, and the greater society. This is where our ignorance, our fear, our sense of lack starts to assert itself. So as a Dharma practitioner, we start to learn to be mindful of those, to notice when those arise and use that as a chance to practice, to actually bring a kind attentiveness to actually see what is this contraction of heart? What is this deeper view that's arising, that wants to lash out, that wants to steal, to cause harm? So we start to find where our leading edge of our practice is. So I encourage you to reflect on that in this evening and this year, to start to notice where those edges are. As we say the precepts in a little while, you notice perhaps there's a precept that you kind of waver a little bit with. There's a little bit of a stutter in your step, your voice. It's like, oh, I don't quite want to take that one on. All right? So just acknowledge that and bring a little more energy to that. You know, first to understand, to see what is actually present here. You know, not with a judgment, not with trying to fix, but just to know, to see, and see if there can be a starting to churn that toward alignment with wisdom, with compassion. Often you find with those edges, there's this attentive need to justify, to elaborate, to explain. Well, in this case, it's okay for me to break that precept just a little bit. You know, that white lie is not going to hurt anybody. That taking that extra sample at the grocery store, that's okay. You know, that kind of quality of just playing with the edge. See, often we notice with the precepts, when we kind of bump up against them, there's an inherent noise that starts to arise. A sense of a little bit of agitation and not quite being so settled. I have to justify my behavior. I have to explain it, or perhaps hide it, obscure it. Well, when we align with the precepts, with this quality of non-harm, a sense of quiet arises. A sense of stillness arises from that alignment. Right? And this is one of the deep benefits of ethical practice, of the precepts, is that our minds become more and more quiet, more and more steady. From that steadiness, then concentration grows. From concentration, then wisdom grows. It's very hard to have deep insight when our mind is full of agitation, full of fear, of remorse, of regret, of desire, of wanting. All the ways the precepts emerge and erupt out when we start to push up against them is from these deeper forces. And a simple way to look at it is, are we leading from our heart or from our mind? Now, if we connect with our heart, the way is often much more clear. We may not know the details, but there's a sense of, I can align with this. This is an action of non-harm. This is a word spoken from truth. This is a decision, a choice to be more sober, to be more awake. You know, versus the mind, when it gets kind of caught in the defensiveness, the justification, you know, which is driving our actions. So the precepts can be this nice kind of litmus test, this kind of reminder when we bump up against them. We have this urge to break a precept or to bend a precept. And often using that as a wake-up call to say, what's really driving my actions in this moment? You know, what refuge am I taking? The refuge of wisdom, of compassion? Or am I going into the sense of lack, of scarcity, of fear, of anger? The precepts, we can look at them simply as being involved with our relationships. Our relationships to others, to ourselves, to larger groups. And how our actions of those relationships can be based in non-harm. In non-harm in those relationships. So you can look at the precepts at almost three different levels. The sense of relationship to ourselves, you know, how we hold our own bodies, our own minds, you know, the choices we make, the internal dialogue that we enhance and carry out, or the releasing of that. The relationship to others, how we relate to other beings, other people, other humans. And finally, we can also look at the relationship to the earth, to the just kind of global sense of this planet that we all share. And all these three aspects are very critical and vital. Some are going to be more naturally accessible. Some are more difficult. But again, as our practice matures, the really nature of practice is start to bring all these three into a sense of balance, all equally into our lives. Now, our relationship to ourselves, sometimes this is the most difficult aspect, that we can be outwardly very kind, very generous, yet we walk around with such internal judgment and criticism, such harshness toward ourselves. Right? So this is a form of self-harm. Right? It's things, I remember Tori saying this, I think a year ago, the things we would never say to someone else, we are happy to say to ourselves. The sense of judgment, the sense of harshness, we would never say that to another person, yet our own internal dialogue continues to do that. So this, taking these precepts toward ourselves starts to really transform our relationship to everyone else. And that's one of the ways that the practice works kind of in a under the surface way. We learn to just simply meet our breath, meet our sensation, meet this emotion with non-judgment, with kindness. That very relationship starts to bring an ethical stance to that experience. We start to accept ourselves just how we are in this moment. From that sense of acceptance, that stillness deepens. We start to see what's beyond these ideas of I, of me, of mine. Okay, that stillness starts to deepen. And naturally, as we meet another person, we're not meeting them from the sense of differentiation, of difference, of preference, from this much deeper place. know, the relationship to others, this is the kind of the obvious, most spoken of way of working with the precepts. And as we look at our harm that we cause of killing, of harming, of stealing, the precept to refrain from sexual harm, sexual misconduct, from speaking falsehoods, and from drinks and substances which cloud the mind that lead to heedlessness. These are very concrete ways we can see how much harm is caused when we act in that way. How much harm has been caused us when people are breaking those precepts. And so this, again, this edge, there's the impulse that arises. The gift of mindfulness is we can see the impulse without having to act from that impulse. Mindfulness slows down the process. If impulse arises into the reaction, the action from that, you can actually see the impulse just as an object of practice in itself, an object of awareness in itself. In that seeing of it in a clear way, with uncoupling the action that it initiates, that it wants you to do, you start to unhook the deeper drive. Right? This is the power of investigation, seeing underneath the drive, underneath the impulse to that deeper quality of ignorance. And then finally, with the relationship to the earth, this is inspired by the climate group here at SIMS, and they're working on a set of precepts to really hold the earth as a good steward, and how our actions also can harm the earth or benefit the earth. This is shifting from this kind of internal focus to the relationship focus to a much longer focus, or how these actions we do today, the choices we make today, affect, you know, our children's lives and their children's and their children's. And how, what are we stealing from the future? How are we harming the future from our current actions? So this is a lovely part of the precepts. You can literally play with both the internal quality of it, the relational quality, and this much more global way. It's much, much more universal way how it goes into the future. How our actions right now are, we're stewards for this planet. We're stewards for this environment. So these five precepts. So undertaking the training to refrain from. Undertaking the training. So it realizes that we're humans, that we will fail at times, we'll fall down in these. But that sense of undertaking the training, the willingness to take this up as an intentionality, to start to align our actions with our deepest understanding, with our wisdom, to refrain from taking life, from causing harm, to undertake the training to refrain from stealing, from taking that which is not freely offered, undertaking the training to refrain from sexual harm. Our sexuality causes harm throughout, you know, it's so obvious these days as people are actually bringing voice to the harm they've experienced. Undertaking the training to refrain from speaking falsehood in alignment with what is true. And finally, to undertake the training to refrain from intoxication. When we lose that sense of clarity, all these precepts are so much easier to break as we become intoxicated. It's much easier to harm, to steal, to misuse our sexuality, you know, to speak lies. So these precepts are a training that benefits ourselves in a very profound way, but also benefits every being that you come across. And so may all beings live a life free of harm, free of fear. Thank you.
I love ceremony. So all of that, you know, so we can remember this idea that we're actually practicing watching ourselves and how our relationship with ourselves, with others, and, you know, with the earth, we have these cords to kind of help us remember. And so one way that you can do this is you can tie a knot for each of the refuges. Because like Tim was saying, the refuges are the aspiration and the precepts are how we live up to that aspiration, and how it helps us drop down into a way that those refuges become a part of us. And so you can tie a knot for each of the refuges. And then as you're tying that knot to contemplate, translate what it is that you've just heard into what that intention is in each of the knots. And so just take a moment to just think about that. How are we doing? It looks like there's still a few people tying knots. So I want to see a show of hands. How many people know this chant for the... actually, it's the precepts, because I think the refuges we know. But how many people know the precepts? Because I'm trying to find out if I should do a call and response, and it looks like I should, so we're going to do a call and response. And in the precepts, the first part of it, that first word or so, is the thing that changes. The rest of it is all exactly the same. So we'll do a call and response on that first word, and then after we do the response, then we'll all say the last three words together. It's pretty much all the same all the way down. And then one more thing. For the refuges, it depends. Okay, so there's a way in which some people just say the whole line in one tone, and then there are some people that say a little, there's a little, for singers, it like goes up at the end. I like to go up at the end. But if you just say one straight tone, I don't want to create a sense that there's a right way or a wrong way to say, to chant. Chanting doesn't really matter how you sound. You say it however you want to say it, and together, whatever that sounds like, that's the chant. So that you don't feel this sense of, oh, I got to say it like someone else sitting next to me is saying it. It's really your chant. You say it however you say it, and that's fine. And it'll sound beautiful regardless. So we're going to hold our cords together. We usually put our hands together in prayer pose. You don't have to, but we do just, it's mostly because we're trying to hold our energy together with this cord and have an internal reflection, even though we're speaking externally with the chant. All right, so let's start with the Namo Tassa. I will say that three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. So let's do the English part of this. To the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. To the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, for the second time, I'm sorry. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Dhamma, I go for refuge. And for the third time, to the Sangha, I go for refuge. Panatipata, panatipata, viramadi sikapatam samadhiyami. Adinadana, Adinadana, viramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Kamesu, kamesu machakara, machakara, viramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Musawada, musawada, viramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Sira, sira, mirya, mirya, maja, maja, pamadantana, pamadantana, viramani sikapadam samadhiyami. I undertake the precepts to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate boundless compassion towards all beings. I undertake the precepts to refrain from taking that which is not given. I vow to practice generosity. I undertake the precepts to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. I undertake the precepts to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. I undertake the precepts to refrain from intoxicating liquors and drugs, which leads to carelessness. I vow to ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So on the back of this sheet, if you want to take it home, is a, it's kind of monastic chant that you do for the sharing of blessings. And you don't really have to know it very well. It's because the little things over the words tell you whether or not it's one straight sound with the little things tell you when to go up and when to go down. All right. Oh, that's right. So now we need to tie them on. So you can turn to your partner or someone next to you, and then we can actually put these on.